You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
It is a mere 6 days until Christmas. Are you done with your shopping? I know you're not. I'm not. It is Tuesday, December 19th, and we're talking Indians baseball today with Jordan Bastian, our Indians reporter for MLB.com. Jordan, thank you so much for the time, and with the Christmas holiday drawing ever closer, we'll have a little bit of fun at the end of the podcast with some Christmas-themed questions. But before that, we'll get to the news of the day. And, of course, Carlos Santana is going to be making sweet music elsewhere in 2018. He is no longer a Cleveland Indian, as he is off to the Philadelphia Phillies. So, Jordan, that begs the question, what is the plan now for the Indians to fill that hole at first base with Carlos gone?
Well, when we were at the winter meetings and we had a chance to talk to Terry Francona, you know, we posed that question, you know, do you have the guys internally to handle first base if Santana moved on and signed elsewhere? And this was a few days before the news broke that Santana had reached that agreement with Philadelphia. And what Francona said is, you know, yeah, technically they have the guys. Edwin Encarnacion could play first. Lonnie Chisenhall could play first. You know, there's been rumblings about possibly trying Michael Brantley there. So they have the guys that could do it. Yandy Diaz is another guy, depending on how the rest of the defense aligns. You know, they could run him over there in spring and see what they have. But what Francona quickly added was, you know, but I think we would probably want to go out and sign somebody, is what he said. So, you know, right now there's still a lot of free agent first baseman out there. You know, I don't think the Indians are going to be, if they weren't in the market for Santana, certainly don't look like a team that's going to be in the market for Hosmer. But there's some of those second-tier guys that are at least interesting and present different types of scenarios. You know, one guy they've been linked to is Logan Morrison, who's coming off a career year. And, you know, when they look at a guy like that, you have to balance, was last year what he is, or do you put more stock in the career track record? What they had in Santana was consistency over the last 7 years. You know, they knew what they were going to get year in and year out, and he developed into a gold glove caliber defender at the position as well. So it's a big loss, but I think they're going to continue to search for ways to kind of upgrade that spot, or at least upgrade the offense in some way. And then that would in turn potentially have a domino effect and lead one of the internal guys to be at first base.
Yeah, no shortage of options out there in the free agent market for first base with Santana gone. You mentioned, you know, Hosmer, maybe they kick the tires, but you know, like you said, I think like a lot of people agree, they might go to that second tier of first baseman to kind of fill that hole. And again, as you said, you know, Santana was there for 7 years. And, you know, in the course of 7 years, you're going to see a lot of turnover with any lineup, with any roster. Young guys come up. We see the Ramirez's and the Lindors. You see the free agent signings like the Encarnaciones of the world. But Carlos Santana was always there, always such a steadying presence throughout the ups and downs of his 7 year tenure in Cleveland. So from that perspective, in terms of you know, leadership and just overall presence and what he meant to this team, how big of a loss is it through that lens?
Yeah, I mean, this was a cornerstone guy, a guy that when they traded for him was coming up as a catcher with the Dodgers, and he broke into the big leagues as a catcher. And when he signed his extension with the Indians several years ago, at the time it was the largest pre-arbitration extension for a catcher in baseball history. I actually think Yan Gomes might have topped that when he signed his deal with the Indians. Then came the experiment at third base. Then came, you know, the move across the diamond to first base. And he put in a lot of work, as I said, to become a very reliable defender there. And he took a lot of pride in his defense. And I think what we saw more recently in the last few years under Terry Francona was Santana kind of, you know, in the past he was, you know, kind of insistent on being in the field and not DHing. And, you know, you'd hear some moaning here and there, you know, several years ago. And then all of a sudden just this switch flipped and he became this ultimate team-first guy. And I don't know if it was because the Indians, you know, were reaching that point of, you know, becoming a serious contender. Obviously, they reached the World Series 2 years ago, won 102 games last year. But Santana, you know, as the team reached closer and closer to their World Series goals, became way more open to whatever Terry Francona wanted. If that meant DHing or playing first or moving to left field in the World Series, you know, this guy was all over the place. He played right field in interleague play this last year. and just became very willing to do whatever the team wanted, putting the team first. And I think that became, really respected within the manager's office and I think around the game as well as he looked for potential suitors. But like I said, he had his ups and downs offensively, but was kind of a consistent guy. He would draw 80, 90 walks a year, hit 20-plus homers a year, switch hits, moves around the diamond. Really valuable guy, and an image that will forever be remembered by Indians fans was the final out of the ALCS in 2016. You know, he caught the ball in foul ground and dropped to his knees and hoisted his arms into the air as the mob then swarmed the field as they celebrated clinching the pennant. You know, he still kept that ball, and it meant a lot to him that moment because he had spent so much of his career coming up through the Indians minor leagues and, you know, reaching the World Series with that team. So he's a guy that the Indians will miss, and the Phillies are getting a good one.
Absolutely. And, Jordan, any chance that the Phillies and Indians meet in interleague play in 2018 or no?
You know, I don't know off the top of my head. But, if they do meet at any point in the next few years because he's signed for a multi-year contract, right. You know, there will be a lot of players and a lot of staff that will be very happy to see him and happy for him for this deal he got and the deal he earned.
And a huge reception awaiting him. If by chance the Phillies do visit Progressive Field, and like I said, a very warm reception awaits Carlos Santana when he steps into the box for the first time as a visiting player. Jordan, let's move on here. The Indians, it's not official yet, but they've agreed to terms with a veteran at Melvin Upton Jr. Give us the terms of that potential deal when it gets inked and what you see for him in terms of a potential fit at the big league level.
Yeah, I mean, every year they have these guys that could compete for opening day spots. And when you look at the makeup of their outfield, they've got Brantley, Zimmer, and Chisenhall projecting as the starters, potentially Jason Kipnis. All those guys I mentioned are left-handed hitters. So similar to a year ago when they brought in Austin Jackson on a minor league deal that had a spring invite, this feels like almost the same type of idea where it's a right-handed bat, a guy who can play center field or left field, and has a pretty good track record of hitting left-handed pitching. As the Indians sit here today, Brandon Guyer is still recovering from wrist surgery, and he's kind of questionable for opening day. So bringing in a guy like Upton just gives them another option. If he were to make the opening day roster, it'd be $1.5 million plus incentives. And like I said, it's almost an identical situation to Austin Jackson a year ago. Now, I asked somebody if this meant the door was closed on bringing Austin Jackson back, and they said not necessarily, but it's hard to imagine them stocking up on a bunch of these guys. But it's, like I said, similar feel to Austin Jackson, and Austin Jackson obviously was coming off an injury-riddled season like Upton is right now, but Jackson went on to play a very, very important role for the Indians last year.
And this is the very definition of a low risk and potentially very high reward, as they got with Jackson, as you said, this past season, and maybe lightning strikes twice with Melvin Upton Jr. here in 2018. Jordan, you recently wrote about Jason Kipnis and a guy that's been heavily rumored to be, dealt or potentially dealt or, what have you. But his name is out there, and he knows his name is out there. And I think for as much as, guys like to say, I don't read it, I don't listen to it, I ignore it, they're human beings like the rest of us, and for as heavily as his name is out there, he's got to be aware of it. So what is his, general reaction to knowing that, at the very least, the Indians are exploring packaging him in a deal?
Well, Kipnis is not that guy that isn't reading. He reads everything. he scrolls his Twitter feed. He sees what fans are saying. He even jokes around that, about the fans who want him traded. He's a very self-deprecating guy and very sharp and aware. And I think he's a guy that understands the reality of the situation. He knows he was hurt a bunch last year, and he only played 90 games, and he didn't perform when he was on the field. And, when he came back, Jose Ramirez was excelling at second base. And when Bradley Zimmer was out, they tried Jason Kipnis as an outfielder. The Indians really loved the combination of Ramirez at second and Lindor at short. So that sort of led to positional questions about Kipnis, where they picked up Brantley's option if he's the left fielder and Zimmer's back healthy. And they want Ramirez at second. What does this mean for Kipnis? So, Kipnis the first to admit. He said, as I wrote in the article, that he feels that Ramirez is probably the better second baseman, but he feels the team is better if he's at second and Ramirez is at third, just because of the offensive potential that that means for the whole group. And, you know, he's a guy that's always played with a chip on his shoulder. You know, when guys are counting him out or thinking he's you know, not going to bounce back, that's usually when he's at his best. And those are the years he's either made an all-star team or had a strong showing. And he understands the business side. You know, the Indians aren't a team that are going to be out there spending the most money, and he's set to earn over $13 million this year. So he kind of gets that if they were to trade him, maybe it would free them up to do something else in free agency. All of that is understandable, and he gets all that. But what he had said is, you know, this is a team that he grew up with. He was drafted and developed by this team. These are all his best friends in that clubhouse, and they're just coming off a 100-win season, 2 years removed from the World Series, and they have this sense, this really heightened sense of unfinished business given the way last year ended and the way 2016 ended. And he's a part of that group. He's a part of that core group that has come up together and had these goals together. And so for those reasons, you know, he's really hoping he's not traded.
Yeah, of course. Easy to see why he'd want to remain a part of that core and to, like you said, wrap up some unfinished business here in 2018 with, you know, the World Series appearance and the 100-plus win season in back-to-back years. Maybe 2018 is the year it all comes together for the Tribe. Jordan, a couple of rapid-fire Christmas questions to wrap things
sure.
up here down the stretch. Who on this Indians team do you feel would make the best department store Santa Claus?
Man, well, Santana would have been the good answer. kind of got that stocky build, and he's named Santana.
Santana Claus, right?
Could have put on the beard. So I don't know. I'm going to go with I'll go with Kipnis, or I'll go with Cody Allen. I don't know. They just they both got beards. They're both friendly. You know, they can they got good senses of humor, and I think they would both be. Those would be good options. I don't know. That's a tough one.
Big shoes to fill, though, with Santana in Philly, no question. And, Jordan, of course, as we all know from the movie A Christmas Story, all little Ralphie wanted more than anything in the world was his precious Red Ryder BB gun. So for the Indians this offseason, what is their Red Ryder BB gun, if you will?
Well, yeah, I mean, we've talked a lot about it. First base.
Yep.
You know, if they could get somebody to plug in there, it kind of would cause that domino effect for the rest of the roster. But other than that, losing Brian Shaw was a big loss for the bullpen. You know, Tito and Chris Antonetti and some of the other guys have joked that it would take two guys to do what Shaw's done over the last 5 years. So, you know, maybe getting some bullpen depth to stretch out that group that's in place would be on their wish list as well.
And, Jordan, to wrap up, I don't know if there's an answer for a team that won over 100 games, but I'll throw it out there anyway. You know, sometimes there's a player and a fan base that need to kind of kiss and make up after a tough season. So who, if anybody, on this Indians team needs to step under the theoretical mistletoe and start fresh for 2018?
You know, I'll go with Corey Kluber. I mean, that doesn't sound like the obvious pick because he's coming off his second Cy Young season, but it was the way it ended. He had that rough October. You know, the reports that something might have been ailing him physically. He didn't pitch as well as everyone thought he was going to in the playoffs. And, you know, that contributed. It wasn't the only reason that the Indians had an early exit, but it contributed to it. So I think fans are hoping Corey Kluber can come back and be the same guy in the regular season and keep it going into October.
Yeah, one of those rare cases where a guy, you know, enters a season having won a Cy Young Award but still has a chip on his shoulder and something to prove. You don't see that dynamic very often, but that is what Corey Kluber is going to have for that dynamic in 2018, and we'll see how the Klubot responds. Jordan Bastian, great stuff as always. Happy holidays to you and your family, and we'll speak again, I believe, sometime in 2018. So we thank you again for the contributions. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Cleveland Indians. We're talking White Sox baseball today on this Thursday, December 21st, as Christmas draws ever closer. Scott Merkin joins us on the podcast today. Scott, our White Sox reporter for MLB.com. And, Scott, as always, we thank you for the time. I think, you know, the place to start here, Scott, is obviously with I don't want to call it, it's, you know, it's not news. It was all just rumors and speculation. But for a couple of days, you heard talks about, you know, the White Sox and Manny Machado. And I think that as we talk here on this Thursday, the Orioles have kind of given up hopes on dealing Machado because their asking price was sky high for a guy who was just going to be basically a one-year rental before he hits free agency in 2018. But going back, you know, when these rumors got started, how did they get started? And was there ever any real legitimacy to Rick Hahn, you know, seriously contemplating giving up some of his prized farm prospects to get one of the elite players in the game?
They definitely had interest. There's no question about that. But there's a difference between interest. I mean, let's start to the beginning. Manny Machado is, I've used this phrase a couple times, a generational talent. You know, he's an unbelievable player. He's as good defensively as he is offensively. I know he struggled a little bit at the beginning of last year, but a great franchise-type player. But there's a difference in what you're willing to trade for Manny Machado for 1 year in the middle of a rebuild than if you had the chance to kind of negotiate and do a multi-year deal with him, which, again, probably doesn't make a lot of sense when he's coming upon, you know, what could be a very lucrative free agent deal. So the Sox were interested, but I can say with almost near certainty that they were not giving up Yoan Moncada. They weren't giving up Eloy Jimenez. They weren't giving up Michael Kopech. They weren't giving up Lucas Giolito. Insert name there of, you know, top four or five prospects that they were not trading for 1 year of control. The White Sox have worked very hard, very diligently, and pretty much expertly to date to kind of reshape this franchise. You know, their goal is not to win the wild card in 2018 and have an outside shot of maybe getting to a, you know, divisional series and then getting eliminated and saying, well, we almost. That might have been a little bit, that was never the goal, but that might have been a successful season in the past. Their success now is based on competing for championships every year. You know, it's hard to win every year, but competing every year. And if that means a couple down years and then maybe a year where you're starting to make progress and then 2020, there it is. That's what they're looking for. So I think there was interest. I think they made an offer. I don't think it had, you know, and I'm not taking away from any players who might have been offered and that also good players, but not guys who possibly were going to change the franchise. And, you know, in that sense, I mean, they're not going to, Rick said this a number of times on the Thursday without talking about Machado specifically, that Thursday, I should say, of the winter meetings, the last day in Orlando, in that they're not going to, their goal is long-term success, and they're not going to suddenly rechange the focus in the middle of this process. And they basically are in the middle of this process right now.
And, you know, Scott, I know, let's play a game here of what if, as outlandish and crazy as this suggestion may sound. Let's say, for instance, that Manny Machado tells his agent, you know what, if the White Sox want me, I'm going to sign a 10-year insert number of money here extension with the team, and they've got me for the, you know, if not the rest of my career, the prime of my career. You know, if that agreement was in place, do you see Rick Hahn then saying, all right, you know what, you can have our top three guys. You can have a Moncada, a Jimenez, a Giolito, or do you still say that Rick Hahn sticks to the plan and passes on having 10 years of Manny Machado?
Well, it's a great hypothetical, actually, and I don't want to speak for Rick because he's got the plan, but I would say the talent return is different. And again, you don't want to diminish anyone who is offered. They're also very good players. But in terms of, like, let's say prospect rankings or young player rankings, the talent return has got to be different if you're getting 1 year of a guy in a season you don't really intend to contend versus 10 years of a guy who could be the cornerstone of, you know, a multi-championship run. So obviously the package is a little different there. But again, I don't know to what extent it would be, and I don't think, you know, like you said, very hypothetical, and I don't know if that's going to play out unless, like, Machado just has some huge affinity for the city of Chicago. And, you know, why not? It's a great city.
Sure.
But I think he also has an affinity for testing the free agent market from what I've seen and heard, and a lot of players are that way. You know, and you can't blame him. You know, really, you can't blame anyone in this case. You can't blame the Sox for wanting to make a play for a guy who could possibly give you a leg up on signing him in the future if you have him for a full season, who can help these young kids learn how to win, because no one in an organization wants to lose. It's just part of the process of development. But even, you know, the young players, they know what's going on. They know the rebuild. But it's not like they go out there every day and they say, oh, you know, we're 10-26 now. This is awesome. We're going to win in 2 years. They want to win that day. There's no question about it. So Machado helps that. You can't blame Machado, who's worked this hard to get to free agency, if he wants to test the free agent waters and see what he can get. And you certainly can't blame the Orioles, even with 1 year of contractual control, of trying to get as much as they possibly can and maybe even asking what could be deemed unreasonable demands for him, because there's no, you don't have to trade him right now. I mean, maybe they still want to, they still feel like they can contend this year. They can trade him at the trade deadline, you know, if they have to. But I think all parties involved were just doing their, you know, their work, trying to make things better. And at this point, as we're taping this, it doesn't look like it's going to happen right now.
Yeah, I mean, it never hurts to, you know, kick the tires, so to say.
Sure.
And just to see what's out there. But there is a definite blueprint in place. in Chicago, and Rick Hahn is sticking to it. And you know what? Not every prospect pans out, but when you get the cream of the crop from, you know, the Cubs farm system and the Red Sox and the Nationals, you know, when you get their top guys, you're onto something good. So you don't want to let,
I think we've mentioned this before in the podcast, but, you know, Jerry Reinsdorf, the owner of the White Sox chairman, a couple years ago said, you know, because of that, you know, you have to get like 15 or 16 to make sure you have like four or five that actually pan out. Hey, there's a lot of guys who we've seen over time, Matt, that look tremendous in the minor leagues, cannot miss. And then for some reason, they get to the majors and they might have one or two good seasons, and then they just don't pan out, or they become a utility guy. And the Sox realize that, and that's why they're getting so many players, you know, to add to this critical mass. They're relying on, you know, a top four draft pick this year under Nick Hostetler, you know, who's the scouting director for the White Sox, and maybe another high draft pick in the next draft. So a lot of options to add. And the last thing they want to do is subtract some of the big guys they got just for 1 year of a guy who they may or may not be able to influence to stay longer after the year.
Yeah, I mean, in no other sports is drafting more uneven and more of an inexact science than baseball. So, you know, I love Reinsdorf's theory about get 15 or 16 guys and hope four or five of them stick, and then you've got yourself the core of a very good team, and that is certainly the plan in Chicago. So, Scott, it appears that, you know, Manny Machado is not going to be wearing the pale hose in 2018. Do you see anything else up Rick Hahn's sleeve right now, even something, you know, if not earth-shattering, maybe something under the radar a little bit between now and spring training?
Well, I think, Matt, we can all agree that the market's been a little slow to develop, and
just
possibly because – excuse me, there's been some trade machinations out there, you know, Machado waiting to see, you know, Longoria got traded. So those things are kind of coming to an end right now. So I think, you know, where the Sox are looking, they're not looking at right now, for the most part, multi-year guys. You know, Wellington Castillo, we've talked about him in other podcasts that worked out where they didn't even expect it to work out. They had interest in him, and it panned out for, you know, a two-year deal with an option. So I think that's kind of the high side of where they're looking. So the players they're probably looking at for 1 year or maybe 1 year and an option may not pan out until January or maybe even early February. You know, they need relief help. They probably need another starting pitcher, if not two, maybe kind of a swing guy who could start and relieve. And the market they're looking at, it, you know, maybe something comes to fruition, you know, before the end of the year. But I think you're looking more January or February for some of these guys to come to the White Sox.
Yeah, very slow developing, slow moving free agent
for sure.
Market. In 2017 into 2018, for whatever reason, but hopefully things do pick up after the turn of the new year in less than 2 weeks. Well, Scott, let's get into the holiday spirit with Christmas only 4 days away here, and some fun Christmassy questions to throw your way. The first one being, it's one of my favorites to ask all the reporters, what player on the White Sox roster right now would make the very best department store Santa Claus?
Well, I don't think any of them have the girth to play the image of Santa, first of all, but I think if you're looking, the one thing about the White Sox that they've developed is they have a lot. They have a really good clubhouse, a lot of good people in there. So I think any of them have the good nature to do it. I would probably pick Jose Abreu, just from the interaction I've seen with him with kids through charitable things, or just, you know, talking to fans in the stands. Avi Garcia is another good one, and Yomer Sanchez, who's got the holiday spirit, Christmas spirit. The entire year round, I think, would be good. But I'd go with Jose Abreu, I think, for that answer.
Yeah, some very good options there for sure. Scott, question two. There's players on every team and every clubhouse that sing after every game or think they can sing. Sometimes it's a fine line. So with that in mind, if the White Sox had a Christmas caroling group going door to door, what players would be front and center in that caroling group?
Well, if you asked me early in season last year, I would have an easy answer for you. Miguel Gonzalez, who's a very accomplished mariachi singer.
Wow.
So he would have been a great answer. He's a free agent right now, so I can't include him. Giovanni Soto was another guy who you always heard singing in the clubhouse. It was actually pretty good. It's another one. I think I'm just going to go with Sanchez, just because he's just got that kind of exuberance, that youthful exuberance, that he'd probably be able to pull it off, even if he didn't have a good voice. So I think he'd be into it, even if he wasn't a good singer, so I'm going to put him in there. But
sometimes,
if they get Gonzalez, if they somehow bring him back as one of those starters that I was talking about, then we move him to the top as the Christmas carol singer.
There we go. And for Sanchez, sometimes, you know, the effort can make up for the lack of talent.
Exactly.
So maybe,
that's how I look at it, because I can't sing at all. But, hey, I still try karaoke.
A for effort. Great stuff. Great stuff. Scott, to come down the home stretch here, of course, as we all know from the movie A Christmas Story, all Ralphie wanted for Christmas more than anything else was that precious Red Ryder BB gun. So for the White Sox this offseason, and maybe it's a tricky question to answer given their rebuilding mode, but what would be their Red Ryder BB gun this winter?
Well, I think instead of going for a player or a position, I'm going to go with patience.
Okay.
Because this is kind of the developmental stage of the rebuild. They have a lot of players. They're still going to add some more through draft and probably more deals as the season goes on. But this is the time where they have to be patient and watch these guys develop and then eventually see where they have to kind of fill in through, you know, trades of younger players for established veterans or free agent signings. So I think patience is what they need for this year. And I think patience is what they have, too.
Love the answer. And, Scott, the final one here. Sometimes a player and a team's fan base might need to kiss and make up after having a rough season. So which player, and again, this might be tricky to answer given where the White Sox are, but is there a player on this team that maybe had a rough 2017 that needs to step under that mistletoe and, you know, kiss and make up and start fresh for next year?
Well, it's funny, man. If you'd have done it a year ago, Avi Garcia would have been the answer.
Yeah.
You know, he had struggled to live up to potential, and there was even some talk maybe he would be non-tendered. And now he's an all-star, 80 RBI guy. I think he had the third highest average in all of baseball last year behind Altuve and Blackman. So there's no making up there. He's now a fan. He's got the seal of approval from every fan. You know, I guess the only one I could think of is probably James Shields, who has struggled quite a bit his first year and not as bad last year since joining the White Sox. I can't say enough about what a good guy James Shields is and what a consummate veteran is and how many young pitchers have told me how much of an influence he has over them. But I'm sure the White Sox would like to see, even in a rebuilding year, a little more competitive status. And he was. He did show that at the end of last year and by, you know, changing his arm angle a little bit. So I think he's back on that way to reinventing himself and being competitive. And you got to give the guy credit because he got hit with a line drive last year on the mound and made his next start. So the toughness, the knowledge, the grit, the, you know, just the spirit is there. Just probably need a little more results. But that's the only one I can think of. And even James made a turnaround in 2017.
Yeah, I mean, a guy that wants to get back to living up to that big game James nickname, and maybe 2018 is the year that he does just that. Scott Merkin, great stuff from you as always. A happy holiday to you and yours. And we'll do it again after the turn of the new year in 2018, which is not that far away, hard to believe. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Chicago White Sox. 6 days away from Christmas, where does the time go? Tuesday, December 19th is the date. We're talking Tigers baseball today with Jason Beck, our Tigers reporter for MLB.com. Jason, we thank you as always for the time. And Ian Kinsler, of course, is no longer a Detroit Tiger, traded to the Angels. And what a busy offseason they're having out in L.A. as Kinsler, now a member of the Halos, ending his four-year run in the Motor City. And Jason, even though, you know, as you wrote, Kinsler kind of came to the Tigers at the tail end of that, you know, dynamic run at the top of the AL Central, you know, winning year after year after year, never got to be part of a postseason victory. But nonetheless, you know, talk about the impact he had during his four-year stay in Detroit. He's somebody that I feel the Tigers fan base is certainly going to miss.
Yeah, well, I mean, even though he didn't have the longevity of Verlander in the Tiger uniform, I think he was just as big a part of that ball club and certainly as big part of that clubhouse, if not bigger. He really became a leader on the team. Ironically, something he wasn't looking to do when he first came over in the Prince Fielder trade. But as time went on, just his style of play, his competitiveness, his desire to play the game the right way, I think rubbed off on players. And he kind of brought an edge to a team that kind of needed it. He solidified a leadoff spot in a way that the Tigers hadn't really seen since Austin Jackson's rookie year. But also defensively, I think he charted a new path for the Tigers' infield defense, one which, you know, it was an infield that people kind of saw as a joke defensively for a couple of years there when they had Prince Fielder at first and Miguel Cabrera at third. And then all of a sudden, not only does Cabrera move to first base and hold his own, but between Kinsler and Iglesias, they really became one of the more, I think, fun to watch double play combos and really one of the more prolific double play combos in the league, and really kind of transformed the way the Tigers could convert ground balls into outs. So I think all around, the Tigers are really going to miss him. Even if they're not going anywhere in 2018, what he provides from a leadership standpoint, that's not easy to find. And I know the Tigers have guys who want to step up. Al Avila was talking about at the winter meetings, the guys like Nick Castellanos have stepped up and say, I want to be a leader. But it's not that easy, and it takes the right personality. And for some reason, Kinzer was that guy, and it's hard to duplicate.
Yeah, absolutely. And, Jason, take us back, you know, to when that trade went down that you referenced between, you know, involving Ian Kinzer coming from Texas and Prince Fielder going to Texas. You know, that was a star-for-star deal. If I recall, there were other, you know, components and players involved in that trade. But rarely do you see, you know, two players of that equal star caliber exchanged in a deal. Now, they're two completely different players, obviously, talking about Prince Fielder and Ian Kinzer. But at the time, how was that trade received by the Tigers fan base?
Well, I mean, it was a one-for-one deal. So there really were no prospects or anybody mixed in. It was more of an exchange of contracts with the Tigers, excuse me, kicking in some money to cover part of Prince Fielder's salary. But I think a lot of people in Detroit saw it as trying to fix an issue that was becoming apparent on a team that had too many first base DH types. And while I think people had respect for Kinzer and what he did in Texas, I don't think many, if any, Tigers fans anticipated the impact he would have once he came over. And it really jump-started his career. If you look at the numbers he put up in Detroit, I don't know if anybody expected that. And he proved some people wrong, including some Rangers people. But also, I think by the end of the deal, people saw in a vastly different way. It wasn't just about jettisoning Prince Fielder and changing the look of the Tigers. It was as much, if not more, about Ian Kinzer. Now, part of that is because Prince Fielder only played a couple more years. But Kinzer really fit this team and transformed this team in a lot of ways, like we said. And I think when you look back at Dave Dombrowski's time as Tigers GM, you really have to include that as one of his better deals.
No question. And Kinzer certainly got it done at the plate in spades. And then, like you said, to watch the combination up the middle of him and Jose Iglesias, I mean, highlight reel after highlight reel, that was a lot of fun. Great partnership for a couple of years. But now, of course, everybody's moved on as the Tigers in full rebuild. And Kinzer part of a very intriguing Angels team. Of course, they nagged Shohei Ohtani, and they made some other moves. And we'll see what kind of a team they field out there in L.A. here in 2018, which Ian Kinzer is now a part of. So, Jason, this all begs the question, what is the plan now with second base for the Tigers going forward?
Well, at least for the foreseeable future, you've got Dixon Machado fitting in there. I think they'd like Machado to play shortstop, but they still have Jose Iglesias for one more year. They don't expect to be trading him this offseason. I don't think they believe that they can get fair value for him. And he's got a little bit more of an affordable salary than Kinzer does at this point. Plus, they also don't really have a set successor long-term at second base. It's one of those things where I think you forget that right around that same time that the Tigers acquired Kinzer, or shortly thereafter, they also traded away Devin Travis to Toronto for Anthony Gose, which did not end up being one of Dave Dombrowski's better deals.
No.
And Travis is the guy that they could have used long-term, whether it's in the infield or in center field. But you know, they have a prospect, Joel Lugo, who came over as a third baseman from the Diamondbacks organization. He's got a strong arm. He's a little big, so you wonder whether he can fit long-term in second base. I think time will tell on that one. But the bat plays well enough to where they want to find a place for him in the lineup. And I think with Jaime Candelario seemingly a long-term answer at third base, they'd like to see Lugo make the transition over to second. And if he can do that, then you could foresee him either getting to second base in Detroit maybe by the end of the year, maybe in 2019, or the Tigers at least reaching some sort of decision by then, maybe depending partly on what they see out of Machado and what they see out of the non-roster invites they're going to try to bring in to help give them some starts behind Machado as well.
Yeah, that could be the most up for grabs position during spring training for the Tigers in 2018. We'll see how that whole thing transpires. And Jason, moving ahead to this is something that we've covered, you know, in depth at the winter meetings when it was announced that Alan Trammell and Jack Morris both elected to the National Baseball Hall of Fame, and both of them overcome with emotion. Jack Morris, especially in multiple press conferences that he gave. But to kind of wrap up the discussion on those two, in your conversations with both Trammell and Morris, what were your biggest takeaways about their reaction to getting elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame after all these years?
Well, I think Jack Morris was way more emotional than any of us expected. He really, you know, I think anybody who saw the press conferences and talked to him saw the really tears of joy and tears of, I don't think he really expected this to happen once he didn't get in on the writer's ballot. I think he really believed it was over. Now, part of that was, you know, this new modern era baseball committee was kind of a mystery as far as nobody really knew how they were going to react. Nobody knew if it was going to be more like the old veterans committee where it was nearly impossible to get the 75% vote for guys to get in. Even though the makeup of the committee was different, now you're talking about a committee of guys who played in that era and played against a lot of those players who were on the ballot, as opposed to a lot of older guys and a lot of guys who maybe didn't necessarily play the game. But you know, Morris was very much taken aback. Trammell took it, you know, about the way I expected. Very gracious. And really constantly smiling. He's one of the most, I think, consistently positive people I've been around, not just in baseball, I think even just people. And I think it really reflected in the way he handled the situation leading up to the vote, and then especially afterwards. I think he was really kind of a rock for Morris in some ways in that press conference. And it'll be interesting to see if we see any emotion from him once he's up there at that podium in Cooperstown making a speech. But so far, the grace with which he's handled it has been the same that you saw out of him when he was on the writer's ballot and not coming nearly as close to induction as a lot of Tigers fans felt like he deserved.
Yeah, absolutely. And it took, you know, 33 long years, but, you know, finally we have not one but two players from the Tigers' last world title team in 1984 that will get through the hollow doors of Cooperstown coming up next summer. So hats off again to both Alan Trammell and Jack Morris, who's done a lot of work for us here at MLB.com over the years. I've had the pleasure of working with Jack on multiple opportunities, and thrilled for him. And I know the Tigers fan base is thrilled for both of them. That goes without saying. Jason, as we come down the home stretch here, Michael Fulmer, his name has been out there in multiple trade rumors, and I think fans are kind of split on the consensus regarding him. I think some fans kind of feel, you know, this is a guy that you keep if you're in a rebuilding mode because he's young, he's controllable, and he's very good. Other people feel, well, because you're rebuilding, that's a prime piece that you deal because of that control and because one guy could fetch you maybe three or four. What side of the fence do you fall on regarding Michael Fulmer?
Well, I think eventually Michael Fulmer is probably going to be dealt. Unless the Tigers get back to contention with their prospects that they have a lot quicker than expected, he's really the one chance for them to get a Chris Sale type of deal, the type of guy who could get you multiple top prospects and a handful of prospects to really jumpstart this system. And I think when you look at the deals that have gone down over the last 6 to 8 months, they haven't been able to get that type of package yet. Even the Verlander deal, while Franklin Perez is a very good pitching prospect and now tops their prospect rankings on the MLB pipeline, and Jake Rogers has a chance to be a nice fit at catcher long term once he gets to the big leagues. I think if you could get a team that's deep in prospects like the Yankees to give up multiples of those prospects, you know, and by multiple, I'm talking like probably like a four prospect package, maybe three really good prospects, It's going to be hard for the Tigers to turn that down just because they need those guys. They need that type of depth. You know, it's kind of similar to what they had to do with Curtis Granderson back in 2010, or even with Jeff Weaver, who wasn't that old, when he was dealt in 2002. I think Dombrowski at those points recognized what they had to do, and I think Alavila, with each deal, realizes that while they have the makings of a very good rotation in their farm system, once these guys start coming up, they still need impact hitters, and I'm not sure how else they're going to be able to get those guys right now, without multiples of good draft picks and, another trade or two. And Fulmer's really by far their best asset to trade.
Absolutely. And, like we said, Michael Fulmer, as good as he is, he's still just one person. And if that one person can get you three or four back, then I think that's a deal Alavila has to make. And I think most Tigers fans would certainly agree. Well, Jason, as we begin to wrap up here, I had a whole list of Christmas-themed questions I wanted to throw at you. But a lot going on in Tigerville the last week or so. So we're going to cut that a little bit short. But one thing I do want to ask you, with regards to Christmas, which again is just six short days away, as we all know in the movie A Christmas Story, little Ralphie, he just wanted that Red Ryder BB gun more than anything else in the world. So if you're the Tigers right now, I guess what would be their Red Ryder BB gun? What's the one thing they want more than anything else? You know, if not a particular player, maybe an objective or a goal. So again, what would their BB gun be this offseason?
I think an elite hitting prospect would kind of fit that scenario. I don't know if that guy's out there. It doesn't sound like they're going to be able to do a whole lot on the international market this winter. And as we've talked about, they've pretty much done what they could on the trade front, unless something comes together for Fulmer that I'm not foreseeing until next season. But really, that's what they need, and I think that's what they badly want. They have a lot of good hitters in their system. They have guys who, if everything goes right, can make impacts, but I don't know if they have that star hitter yet along the lines of what they have potentially pitching-wise in their system. That's what they want. That's the BB gun.
Yeah, this, absolutely. Those guys aren't falling from trees, but maybe, like you said, if a Fulmer deal is consummated, maybe there's a guy out there in someone's farm system that can become Tigers property and become the next, Miguel Cabrera, if you will. We'll see what happens over the course of the winter. Jason Beck, great stuff as always. We thank you for the time and a happy holiday to you and yours, and we'll do it again sometime in 2018, which is not that far away, hard to believe. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Detroit Tigers. It is Tuesday, December 19th, six short days until Christmas. And with that, we're talking Royals baseball today with Jeffrey Flanagan, our Royals reporter for MLB.com. Jeffrey, we thank you so much for the time. And as I said, less than 1 week until the Christmas holiday. And with that, we're going to kind of end the podcast with some holiday-themed questions, if you will. We'll have a little bit of fun. But first, I want to get a couple of news updates on your end, beginning first and foremost with Ned Yost. As everybody knows by now, had that terrifying fall from a tree about a month and a half ago, if memory serves. And it was, I don't think people realized at the time how serious this was and how life-threatening this was, but it was indeed all those things. But give us an update on Ned, and it seems like he's getting better with each passing day.
Yeah, there's some good news there. He had a checkup last night to check on his progress, and he's up to the stage. He's out of the easy chair, which he had been stuck to for 23 and a half hours a day, and then a little wheelchair. Now he's actually using crutches for small sample sizes. I mean, we're not talking, walking around Georgia, the state of Georgia with it, but he is using crutches for a little bit, getting used to that. So that's all good news. And, we hope to, I don't think we'll see him for FanFest at the end of January, but we really hope to see him opening a spring training in February.
Is there an expectation that he's going to be, back on his feet and completely 100% by the time spring training opens up, or could there still be some rehab left by that point?
Oh, I think there'll be rehab left. The people I've talked to that know about these types of injuries take a long, long time to heal, and especially for anyone who's over 60, so it even takes longer. But Ned is one of the toughest guys I've ever been around. So if there's a way he can function normally at spring training, he will do it. Now, as you know, spring training, it's pretty spread out. There are fields everywhere, and there's a lot of walking around, and I just kind of wonder how that will affect him. So I don't know for a fact if he's going to be 100%. I don't know that he won't be. I think it's just too early to tell. We're still, 7 weeks away from spring training, and hopefully he continues to heal and progress.
Jeffrey, have you spoken with him one-on-one yet? Can you speak to his demeanor and his mood since this whole thing happened?
Yeah, actually, I was the one who kind of broke the story about a month ago that this was really a life-threatening deal, and we spoke one-on-one for probably about 30 minutes one morning, and that's when I kind of, the gravity of the situation set in with me as he talked a lot about, laying on the ground and wondering how bad it was. He didn't think it was that bad at first, and then when he got to the hospital, the doctors, the surgeon actually told him, we thought we were going to lose you on the table. We thought we were going to bleed out. We just could not stop the bleeding, and that's when reality set in for him, too, and his wife, Deborah. They at that time, they didn't think it was life-threatening, but obviously it was.
Yeah, obviously. And we hope that Santa brings him a speedy recovery underneath his Christmas tree, because the game is better with Ned Yost. I think we can
agree
on that point. Absolutely. And we hope that his recovery continues to go well and that he's back on his feet 100% by the time that spring training rolls around. As you said, not too far from now. It's you look at the calendar, and it's coming up quick. So hopefully we wish the best here for Ned Yost, of course. Jeffrey, switching gears here, of course, all eyes continue to be on Eric Hosmer, part of a, marquee free agent class. He's one of the big names out there. And it seemed like, you hear his name attached to a couple of teams. We've heard Padres in recent weeks. We've heard Red Sox in recent weeks. But now, just yesterday, as we're speaking here on a Tuesday, the Red Sox re-signing their first baseman from last year, Mitch Moreland, to a 2-year deal. So that theoretically takes them out of the Hosmer sweepstakes. So now, if you're a Royals fan and you see this and you see that one of the potential suitors for Hosmer is pretty much out of the race, is there a pulse here? Is there some glimmer of hope that maybe, just maybe, something could get done between Hosmer and the Royals?
I think there is. I mean, it was kind of assumed that the Red Sox were going to at least make a strong bid for him, and they were, maybe one of the few remaining big market teams who, could lay out that kind of money. And then the Mitch Moreland signing came on, which, really kind of hit everybody by surprise. I mean, I don't think anybody in Boston saw that coming. I didn't read any tweets or anything like that it was even rumored. So that definitely takes them out. We would think it takes them out of the Hosmer sweepstakes, as you mentioned. And, now it could come down to the Royals and the Padres of all teams, the two small market teams. We don't know yet. I mean, there could be, there's always a mystery bidder out there that we haven't identified yet. But certainly if the Royals do get into that situation, and he's been a target since the end of the regular season. They've always wanted him, even though they're going through a rebuild. They really like his presence in the clubhouse. Obviously, he's very productive on the field. He's great in the community. He's the type of guy they would like to sign long-term and, maybe even be a George Brett type here, where he ends his career here, like Alex Gordon probably will. But it's going to take some financial maneuvering, because Dayton Moore told me at the winter meetings that if by some chance they could, re-sign him, they are going to have to shave payroll. They do not want to go over $120 million in payroll this year. They would even like to shave it below that. So if you take off, if you add 18 to 20 for whatever Haas is worth on the market, well, that's got to get you got to balance the book somewhere. So it'll take some creativity for Dayton to do that. But it's like you said, it's got a pulse right now, much more than it did 2 days ago.
Yeah, it sure seems that way. And Jeffrey, to me, and I'm sure to you too, Hosmer is one of the more fascinating cases in free agency this offseason, because the arguments I hear against him is that, well, for a first baseman, he's not a power guy. He's a mid-20 homers guy. The argument against that is, well, he plays 81 of his games in cavernous Kauffman Stadium. So you put him almost anywhere else, maybe he hits you 30-35. you know, is the truth somewhere in the middle, or, you know, how do you assess that part of Hosmer's game?
Well, I think there's no question. Look, if he played at Camden Yards, Yankee Stadium, perhaps even Fenway, I know I've seen the metrics, you know, that say, well, it wouldn't make that much of a difference. But, you know, that's from pass hitting. You know, players at Kauffman Stadium don't swing for the fences because it's fruitless. I mean, you just hit a lot of fly balls to the warning track. So I think if he went one of those places, especially his opposite field power, at Camden Yards, are you kidding me? I think he'd hit 40 or 45 there. He's one of the best, maybe even the best opposite field hitter in baseball. Get him to a short park, those numbers are going to skyrocket. So that part of the argument, I don't buy at all. You know, and I also don't buy the argument that, you know, he's not a Gold Glove first baseman, because I've watched pretty much every single game he's played, and it's over 1,000 of them with the Royals, and he is a magician around first base. Does not have great range. I will concede that. He will concede that. But he's probably saves anywhere from 40 to 70 errors a year with his ability around first base to not just scoop balls on errant throws, but balls that are way high, way right, way left. I've never seen anybody that good at saving errant throws. And that just saves you a ton of outs, a ton of wear and tear on a pitching staff, not to mention all the runs you save. That part of his game is vastly overlooked by some of the so-called advanced metrics.
Well, one thing we know for sure, Scott Boras is making all these same arguments in favor of his client. Because
you think so? You think he's going to tune into that?
One or two. Yeah, I think he's definitely got these things on rehearsed word for word as he tries to get his guy nine figures and then some. And we'll see how that transpires throughout the course of the winter here. So, Jeffrey, as we come down the home stretch, let's have a little bit of fun. As I mentioned, of course, with Christmas just 6 days away, a few Christmas-themed questions with regards to the Kansas City Royals. So, Jeffrey, let's start here. Which player would make the best department store Santa Claus on this Royals team?
That's the easiest one of all. That's got to be Salvador Perez. Yeah. I could just see him in the Santa Claus outfit, the white beard, smiling all the time, bouncing kids off his knees. And he would love it. Fans would love it. That's a no-brainer.
All right, awesome. Question two, Jeffrey. Which player or players do you see being part of a Christmas caroling group going door-to-door on Christmas Day?
Well, you know, a year ago, it would have to be Gerard Dyson, because he could never shut up in the clubhouse. He was singing all the time. That guy this year was Danny Duffy, especially if he had a start that night. He'd be singing, whether it was reggae or R&B or even country music. I mean, he would be singing. He's got an awful voice, and it was just hilarious to hear. So I would like to see that happen, the caroling. I mean, they might just shut the door on him and pull the shades.
Yeah, maybe that would be a hint, but he might not take it. Jeffrey, question three. Of course, as we all know, little Ralphie from A Christmas Story, all he wanted that Christmas was his Red Ryder BB gun. He got it. So the question is, for the Royals, what is their Red Ryder BB gun this season, if you will?
Eric Hosmer.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it just changes the dynamic as they go through this really dramatic rebuild. If you can at least still have Salvador Perez and Eric Hosmer on the team, I think for the fan base, that would be huge. Just the reputation they have around the league. Eric Hosmer is just one of those tremendous influences in the clubhouse. And if you're going to go youth and bring a lot of young kids come up, he's the perfect kid, a perfect guy to shepherd in these kids.
And Jeffrey, the final question here. Sometimes, you know, we'll see a case where a player and a team's fan base need to kind of kiss and make up after a rough season. So from that regard, who needs to step under the theoretical mistletoe and start fresh with the fan base in Kansas City for 2018?
I think I'd probably say Ian Kennedy, because he's got three more years. You know, some of the other guys who had rough years, like Soria, Herrera, and so forth, you know, they might get traded. But Ian Kennedy's going to be here with the length of his contract. And after a really terrific start last year in April, he got hurt, never was the same again. And I know the fan base got really down on him as he continued to serve up gopher balls, and his ERA kept skyrocketing, and I think he's going to bounce back big time. But I think after his first year where he had, 3.68 ERA and fans were pretty happy with him. They were equally as down on him last year. So that's a relationship that definitely could use a mistletoe.
Yeah, I agree. And sometimes, you know, you don't find out until the off season that a guy for, you know, weeks or even months on end was pitching through pain, pitching through an injury, and that could cause a downturn in some numbers. That happened with Kennedy, and hopefully a bounce back is in store for 2018. Jeffrey Flanagan, great stuff as always. Thank you for the time, and a happy holiday to you and your family. We will talk again, I believe, sometime in 2018. In the meantime, it's Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Kansas City Royals. It is just 4 days until Santa comes down the chimney. That's the goal anyway. Thursday, December 21st is the date, and we're talking Twins baseball today with Rhett Bollinger, our Twins reporter for MLB.com. Rhett, we thank you as always for the time, and we're going to touch on pitching, and more pitching. We'll talk about the pursuit of Yu Darvish, talk about the signings of veterans Michael Pineda and Fernando Rodney, and at the end, we're going to tie this thing together with some fun stuff, some Christmas-themed questions, as, again, the Christmas holiday is just days away. But first thing is first, let's talk about the team's pursuit, as I said, of arguably the marquee free agent pitcher on the market this year, that being right-hander Yu Darvish. And I think it's still something of a long shot, maybe not as much of a long shot now as it was, say, you know, 2-3 weeks ago. But how can you, you know, how do you assess the progress, I guess, of the team's pursuit of getting Yu Darvish in that rotation?
The Twins are definitely very serious about Yu Darvish. It's definitely a priority for them. Having talked to, you know, the front office at the winter meetings, talking to Thad Levine and talking to, you know, Derek Falvey and even Paul Molitor, they all kind of talked about how someone that they definitely is on the radar, someone they'd love to have on their team. Obviously, Thad knows him very well from his time in Texas, which I think gave him a little bit of an edge there that Darvish knows him well. He was part of the negotiations when he originally signed coming over from Japan. As you said, it still might be a little bit of a long shot just because we know historically the Twins have never really, you know, paid for an ace like that before. We know the most they've ever spent, you know, in free agency was $55 million on Urban Santana. And luckily for them, that contract has worked out. It pitched very well for them. But they'd like to get somebody who's at least Urban Santana's caliber, whether it's Darvish or, you know, maybe going after an Arrieta, which also might be a little bit more unlikely. But even, you know, Lance, we talked about in the past, but, you know, whether it's Lance Lynn or Alex Cobb, those might be, you know, guys would make some sense as well. But they're going to go in on Darvish. They're going to try to their best to try to convince him that Minnesota would be a good place for him to pitch. He'd instantly become their ace. So far, Darvish has met with a lot of teams individually and privately. He hasn't done that with the Twins yet, but he's expected to, because I do think there's some interest mutually on both sides, but it's just hard to predict right now. You know, you really can't even say there's a clear leader for Darvish at all. We don't really know, you know, what kind of market's out there for him. We know he's a top starting pitcher. You know, haven't really heard much from the Dodgers. You know, obviously that's the team he finished the season with, if he would re-sign there, but we know that, you know, that some other teams out there have had some interest, including the Cubs. But there's not really a clear favorite. So I think that kind of does work in the Twins' advantage. They could be part of this mix here. Like I said, historically, it would still be a surprise if they were to sign him, but it would definitely be a big addition for this team that needs pitching, especially going forward.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, the Twins are not known for making these big, luxurious free agent splashes in the offseason, but hey, there's a first time for everything, and maybe Yu Darvish is the first time for this Twins franchise to really shell out some serious money and put a bona fide ace at the top of that rotation. No disrespect to Urban Santana, of course. But, Rhett, of course, a big X factor here is that because he was traded midseason from the Rangers to the Dodgers, there was no draft pick compensation attached to Yu Darvish. That's a big factor. So would you assess that? Is that the main reason that the Twins are pursuing him? Or even if there was draft pick compensation, would he still be front and center on their radar regardless of that?
I think it's just more of a bonus that he's not going to be tied to it. But I think even if he was, there would still be interest from the Twins, just because there's still, you know, a lot of interest in Lance Lynn and Alex Cobb, and they're both tied to draft pick compensation. But it's always curious to see, you know, sometimes the players that are tied to that, you kind of see their value go down a little bit. I think, you know, we've seen it now with Mike Moustakas. You know, he hasn't had much of a market as a third baseman, as a guy that was offered a qualifying offer. If anything, sometimes it can bring down a little bit of the value of the players because teams are, you know, less and less willing to want to give up a draft pick because they know the value that associate with you know, being able to have a high draft pick. If the Twins were to sign one of those guys, they would lose their second pick, so it would be a second rounder. So it wouldn't be too bad. And the Twins have really been stocking up on prospects. Having the number one pick last year in the draft really helped them a lot to have extra picks for their bonus pool. And then they, you know, made a couple trades this offseason for some young prospects as well. and sign a couple international free agents. So they're pretty well stocked in terms of prospects, where they'd probably be okay even if Darvish was tied to it. But they'd rather not lose a draft pick. So I think if anything, it's just a bonus that Darvish being traded was not eligible to be offered that qualifying offer.
Yeah, I think it's no accident that there's more, you know, buzz this offseason about Yu Darvish than there is Jake Arrieta, because Arrieta, of course, does have the draft pick compensation. He's every bit as accomplished as Yu Darvish. You could say even more so. Arrieta has a Cy Young in his pocket, but because there is no draft pick compensation attached to Yu Darvish, that's why you could designate him as the top free agent pitcher on the market this season. Rhett, shifting gears here, the Twins have made a couple of noteworthy signings to their rotation and their bullpen. Of course, talking about Michael Pineda and Fernando Rodney. And Rodney already, there's a neat photo on the Twins' Twitter account of him in his Twins uniform and shooting the bow and arrow, which he is known for. He's going to bring a lot of pizzazz and personality to that Twins team, no question. But the one that really intrigues me, Rhett, to start here is Michael Pineda, because he's had some, you know, he's obviously had the health issues. He's had some knucklehead moments. I recall the one at Fenway Park two seasons ago where he got caught with the pine tar on his forearm or forehead or something. It was it was visible in broad daylight, and the cameras caught it. He was ejected from the game. So he has those moments, but then he's got moments, too, where his stuff is so electric and his ceiling is so high. You keep thinking to yourself, if this guy can ever put it all together between the ears and health-wise, he could be one of the more dominant pitchers in baseball, and I'm betting that's what the Twins are banking on here.
Exactly. I think it was a low, you know, buy low situation here coming off Tommy John. You know, next year you might not even have him pitch for the Twins with his rehab. There's a chance he could come back, you know, in September as a starter or reliever, depending on how his rehab's going. You know, he had his Tommy John surgery last July, I believe. So it's more about, you know, the next year. Yeah, that's why the contract's also spread out that way, where he's only getting paid $2 million the first year of the deal and then $8 million the next year. So either way, it's a bargain if he can, you know, stay healthy and come back strong from Tommy John. If he would have, you know, been healthy all year there with the Yankees going into free agency, he would have commanded a very large contract. So as he said, there's so much potential there. His slider really is one of the best pitches in the game. I mean, if you look at some of the StatCast stuff on it, the swings and misses he gets with it, the, you know, spin rate and all that stuff he talked about in the past, it's electric. I mean, he really has electric stuff. Like, sometimes it's tough for him to put it all together, but it did seem like the last couple years here, including this season before the Tommy John, that he was starting to kind of put it together, getting his strikeout rate back up above, you know, a batter per inning. So, yeah, I think it's just hoping that rehab goes well. He's got big velocity. The Twins want to keep adding depth to that rotation, and then if it were to work out, you know, always maybe a chance they could extend him if it were to work out. But if anything, it just was a smart way to kind of get a guy they really like to be spotted in that rotation after next year, because Ervin Santana is going into the last year of his contract. The Twins have some young prospects they like, but at the same time, that's why they're so into Darvish and other guys. They want to sign these guys to long-term deals because they want to have these guys that could be potential, you know, frontline starters going forward. And then I think they think that Pineda can be that if he puts it together. So obviously some risk. You never know a guy's come back from Tommy John, but pretty high success rate these days. And the money was so low compared to what he would have got if he was healthy that it made a lot of sense for them.
Yeah, it sure did. He's a nice safety net for the team, like you said, with the impending expiring contracts of Ervin Santana, most notably. And then talk about Fernando Rodney briefly. You know, this guy, he's been well-traveled, but every stop he makes, he seems to, you know, always have a productive season. He's either 40 or close to 40, but he's still getting it done at his advanced age, and I hate saying that, but it's true. So what, you know, was he a main target for the Twins, or did this kind of come together somewhat unexpectedly?
A little unexpectedly, but the Twins were definitely looking for a veteran closer that was going to be a guy that was probably going to be available on a 1 or 2 year deal that wasn't going to be breaking the bank. They probably were never going to go after a Wade Davis type. I always thought it made sense maybe to bring back Brandon Kinsler. He ended up signing for 2 years with the Nationals. There's still a chance the Twins could even bring back Matt Belisle, who indicated at the end of the season he'd like to be back. But Rodney's that kind of stopgap at closer. They've got some young arms and some potential closers on the roster they feel like going forward, like Trevor Hildenberger, Alan Busenitz, Gabriel Moya. They have some young arms they like, but no one on this roster was really ready to close yet. And like you said, Rodney, everywhere he's been, he's racked up the saves. You know, it can be a little bit of an adventure out there sometimes, but he's definitely a proven closer at this point, 40 years old, still has good stuff, still had a lot of strikeouts last year with Arizona. And he's just a fun guy to have in the clubhouse. I know some people, fans see him with a sideways hat or something. I think he's a distraction or a bad teammate or something, but it could be farther from the truth. I covered him a little bit in Anaheim when he was there and talked to other reporters about him that covered him in Detroit and everywhere else, they always say that he was one of the most loved guys in that clubhouse. The players all loved him. He was a jokester. He was like, he was funny. Obviously antics with the bow and arrows and all that stuff, but that's just the thing. He likes to have fun. I don't think he wants to show anybody up. I don't think he really has too many enemies in the game or anything like that. I think he's just like a guy that is fun loving and has, you know, racked up 300 career saves, which is a, you know, pretty impressive feat for a guy that didn't really close till later in his career. So it's one of the things, he'll start the year as the closer. If things go south, they've got some other internal options. But it just made sense, especially the deal, you know, only $4.5 million, you know, plus an option to a club option. So if he ends up having a good year, they can bring him back at the same rate. So another one of those things, kind of a buy low. I think that's why I think still going after Darvish. They have a lot of, you know, payroll. They can, they're on the payroll right now. They have a budget. They can actually go out there and sign a top starter because these moves so far in Pineda, you know, and Rodney were a little bit, you know, kind of low cost bargain signings in a sense.
Yeah, no question. And, you know, going back to what you were saying about a guy that likes to have fun and a good presence in the clubhouse. I mean, let's face it, you know, this game needs personalities like that. Yeah. And we need some, you know, guys that aren't all cookie cutter and guys that, you know, display a little bit of flair and emotion. And Fernando Rodney checks all those boxes. And I think he's going to be a big hit both in the Twins clubhouse and with the fans at Target Field. No question. Rhett, let's wrap up here with some Christmas themed questions beginning here. Which current player on the Twins roster do you feel would make the very best department store Santa Claus?
That's a good one. For me, I guess I'll go with the two of the bigger guys. Maybe I'll go with Miguel Sano or Kenny Vargas. And maybe Vargas more, because Vargas is definitely, actually, you know, both of them are pretty big jokesters. So yeah, I think that they definitely have fun with the kids, and I think they'd fit well into the Santa Claus suit. Of course, I think number one, if he was still on the roster, that would be, you know, Bartolo Colon. I think he'd the best by far. So, but it is cool seeing that. I've seen even some former Twins, former Twin Rene Rivera did a charity event where he dressed as Santa Claus in Puerto Rico and raised a lot of money for kids there in need. So that's always kind of cool to see. But yeah, I think for me, you just see the big guys. I think Bartolo, you never won if you were still on the Twins, but otherwise I think it'd be fun to see Sano or Vargas in a big Santa suit like that, if they make them that big.
Yeah, absolutely. You can't go wrong with either one of those guys, no question. Question two, as we all know from A Christmas Story, all that Ralphie wanted more than anything in the world for Christmas was that precious Red Ryder BB gun. So for the Twins this offseason, what is their Red Ryder BB gun, so to speak?
I think it's got to be Yu Darvish, right? I mean, that's the guy they're targeting. That's their priority. That's the best pitcher on the market. I mean, we talked about earlier, he doesn't have draft pick compensation tied to him. It would be a perfect fit for them. Like I said, just knowing, you know, that Thad Levine knows him so well, there's a little bit of a history there. It would make some sense. So, yeah, and like I said, it would be a big moment in Twins franchise history just because it would blow past the largest free agent signing they've ever had by a lot. And to kind of show that, you know, they're serious. They're serious about competing going forward. They're not just going to make a bunch of small signings and hope that things work out, that they actually want to go out there and sign a frontline guy. So I think that would definitely be the number one thing on the wish list for sure, Yu Darvish.
No question there. And Rhett, to wrap up here, question three, sometimes a player and a team's fan base need to kind of kiss and make up after a rough 2017 season. So who on this Twins team needs to step under that theoretical mistletoe and start fresh for 2018?
I think the person has to probably be Phil Hughes. You know, Hughes tried to pitch through an injury last year. You know, coming off the thoracic outlet syndrome and had part of his rib removed. Tried to pitch, just wasn't working and wasn't pitching well. Went to the bullpen, and then ultimately ended up having season-ending surgery and had more of the rib actually removed. So I think that now he's coming in spring training healthy. There's not a ton of expectations for him, but if he's fully healthy, you know, Hughes is a guy that throws strikes and can be a quality at least back of the rotation starter for them. So it's hard to expect, you know, what he's going to do for them, but at the same time, if he can prove that he's healthy, it might be an unexpected boost and kind of a fresh start for Hughes. He's really dealt with the injury bug the last 2 years, but is still under contract with the team through 2019, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we've seen, when he's healthy, when things are going right, he is an absolute strike-throwing machine. If he can get back to that form in 2018, what a huge boost that would be for the Twins rotation, which may or may not include Yu Darvish. Time will tell. Rhett Bollinger, great stuff as always. We thank you for the time and a happy holiday to you and to all the Twins fans out there. We'll do it again in the new year of 2018. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras Minnesota Twins.